Hello, and welcome to GamesIndustry.biz podcast. I'm Dan Pearson. I'm here at GDC with Justin Marr and Raf Costa. Guys, how's your week been so far?
It's been pretty interesting. It's been a while since... this is Justin Marr here, half of Subset Games. We made FTL and are working on Into the Breach. Yeah, you want to introduce yourself, I guess?
Sure. I'm Raf Koster, and for me, the week has been exhausting. It's pretty tiring. Resorted to naps starting on Monday, which is not a good sign.
Yeah, I fell asleep at like 10:30 yesterday, so too many parties earlier on. But yeah, the week's been interesting for me, unlike other GDCs, because I've had to relearn how to talk to press, as I haven't had to in the past like 3 years.
Yeah.
So it's been a lot of meetings. Very few talks and mostly hanging out with other indie guys. It's just like a big reunion of fun party fest generally.
Yeah, I made it to one talk and it was by a friend of mine about a game that I was there while he was making it, so didn't learn very much. I was there to support him. I think that's actually pretty common though for people who've been to GDC more than a few times. You know, the talks are, a lot of them are aimed at new entrants, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the longer you come to GDC, the less the talks are the important part. The networking is critical.
And
ends
drinking.
Up being, networking, catching up, and friends. Friends you only see once a year, right?
It's like camp.
Yeah, exactly. An exhausting but kind of rejuvenating and revitalizing, right? I always leave GDC charged up.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I work from essentially a cave, interacting with very few people. So I probably talked more, other than my wife, I've talked to more people in the past week than 3 months.
Yeah, same here. I work from home. I do consulting these days, and yeah, I work from home, and you don't see other developers a lot, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's one of the most tiring things about it is the kind of mental and social exhaustion, right? Even though you don't get much sleep, I find I get home and all I want to do is kind of sit in a dark room and not talk to anyone.
I also feel bad because like I'll be having a really interesting discussion with someone and they'll be like, if this was any other day of the year, I would be enjoying this greatly, but I kind of just want to go take a nap. You know? Like I've had like 3 of these in like the past hour.
And a lot of the conversations are amazing. They're like, they're better than the sessions. And then somebody says, but I have to go meet with a publisher in 5 minutes and it's across town, so bye.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot of that that happens.
Yeah, I think
work gets in the way.
We should just ban all the business people from GDC. No offense to industry.biz, but
I think you're right. It's it does often get in the way, and a lot of the stuff does, interesting stuff happens outside the halls as well. And it seems to spread out every year as well. Like, you know, increasingly, I'm just Ubering from one side of town to the other, missing out the most scary thing.
Yeah, which makes me just miss prior venues when it was much more compact, right? It used to be we all fit in the Fairmont lobby in San Jose.
That's great.
Pretty much everybody would fit in one lobby. It was great. It was a very well-appointed big lobby with lots of couches and pockets, but still.
But still, you can feel like you know everyone involved, right?
Yeah, it was actually, you know, this is the San Jose years were, I guess, a bunch of the, what would that be, the 2000s, I guess, you know, that first decade, and late 90s to then. You could actually see the social network of development because look over there is a bunch of people who are all dapper wearing blazers with turtlenecks and they all have expensive sunglasses. Those must be all the developers who are based in LA. And you'd walk over there and sure enough, it's like, oh look, it's Lauren Lanning and the Oddworld guys hanging out with Dave Perry and Jason Rubin. They were all in a pocket. And then you'd go someplace else and you'd see, oh look, there's the Seattle guys.
It was funny.
It was
all carrying their umbrellas.
Yeah. Of course, now you can go out to the Yerba Buena Gardens and it's like, oh, and here's the indies.
That was a little before my time, but I kind of see a little microcosm of the past, like, 5-6 years in the indie scene, where, like, the early days of the indie, IGF and all that, it just felt like everyone, there was a limited number of people, everyone knew everyone, and that's generally just sort of expanded and grown, and now it's sort of diffused into all elements of game development, it seems.
Right, yeah. We used to run, back then, I was doing MMOs, and MMOs just didn't make it onto the main track, right? They were too weird. And there weren't summits back then. we used to just run parallel conferences, and you know, a decade later, Indie does the same thing,
yeah.
and so on, right? You end up running, like, it starts as, let's we all do this, let's have a dinner, and then the dinner turns into, maybe we should hang out all day, and it turns into, maybe we come in the day a day early, and we do something, and then eventually it turns in, yeah, now the process is it turns into a summit.
Yeah. Well, it makes money.
Yeah. It turns into a summit that lasts a couple of years, and if it's not a fad, it kind of dissolves into the main conference, and then it's just in there.
VR track.
If it's not a fad.
Yeah, yeah, well, it's an interesting one. About 60% of my appointments this year have been VR, basically.
Wow, that's okay.
Yeah,
it won't be that way next year.
No, I suspect it may not.
Going to the hall, it was just bizarre. Like, felt like 80% of all the booths had something to do with VR. Yeah.
I did a tally. There were two body gloves, three full body suits, three separate face scanning companies, one hydraulic chair, one VR bicycle, one haptic surface thing that like used electrostatic so you could feel things with your hands while doing hand motions, one shoe insert, and one VR powered fan that would buffet you with wind as you are playing so that you know you're really there. I was like, if there is a machine here that wafts odors at me, VR is dead.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah,
it exists. It's just not on the floor.
Okay. Yeah, they did a promotional one for the South Park game, right, called the Nozulous Rift, which basically just injects artificial farts directly into your face while
you're
playing.
So 10 years ago, exactly that was on the floor as a peripheral. It used little colored cartridges. It was like an inkjet printer for smells, and they were trying to get the engine companies to adopt it. Yeah, that was right before the bubble crashed, right? So, yeah, if that shows up, then I know VR is over.
Yeah, I remember was it Philips that did the kind of color surround as well, you know, so it's kind of, you could program
around
the monitor to change color with the game.
That's still a thing on TVs, actually.
So, I mean, what have you seen that has kind of caught your eye and thought that is definitely going to be here next year? Have you had much of a chance to look around on the expo show floor?
A lot more, over on the expo floors, apart from the game part, you know. Engines, more engines than ever, and it's been interesting to see.
Amazon's lumber,
right? So the lumber, obviously is the big guys. Yeah, obviously is the big guys like Amazon and Unity and whatever, but also lots of smaller ones. So Defold from King, they just gave away for free the engine that they use for building every game at King, and it's sitting there on the floor, and it's like, just take it. There's weirder ones, all kinds of interesting online things happening, like like PlayFab has just grown hugely over the last few years, offering a bunch of back-end service stuff, and now Improbable is out there offering, you know, basically giant-scale MMO simulation as a thing partnered with Google. So yeah, it's been interesting to see kind of the middleware kind of getting interesting, right? I mean, there's also a billion facial capture rigs, but a lot of that. That for me was probably the biggest other thing I saw on the floor there after a few years of it only being Unity and Unreal.
Yeah.
Right? They'd kind of had it sewn up for a while, right?
Yeah.
Well, but Crytek basically, effectively, Lumberyard is... scooped that up, right?
Yeah, so. I did think that they might end up sort of making an acquisition when they were in trouble most recently, and Amazon would just step in and say, well, you know, we kind of need to survive to do all of our tech support. So
I don't think they do need Crytek anymore.
No,
I think they'll just...
You served your purpose.
You served your purpose, exactly. You were the host entity. Now we move on. Yeah,
we've
I don't think they care.
From your carcass now.
Yeah, yeah.
Very vivid imagery.
Yeah.
And I mean, talking about shows and how sort of relevant they are, and how sort of relevance of this sort of changes every year and it kind of evolves constantly, and how that's sort of kept it to be sort of at the forefront of most people's calendars. I mean, we've sort of seen almost the other end of the spectrum happening with E3. You know, it's kind of keeps shifting under the spotlight, and there's kind of sort of curling up and dying a little bit. And they changed some things this year, which is going to make things interesting, I think. I know it's putting a lot of press off, you know, having...
Do you mean the public?
Yeah, so 15,000 extra people, I think, isn't it?
Well, here's, you know, I mean, my first E3s were in Atlanta. So it's been quite a while. The thing to realize, I always tell people, look, when we say the game industry, like when we talk about what is the game industry, all of the business people think the game industry means whoever is running EA, whoever is running, you know, I don't know, whatever. whatever the popular storefronts or publishers or distributors are. The industry is actually the developers, because the business weasels come and go. No offense, industry.biz. they do, right? The developers are the ones who actually stay in the industry 20 years. It's actually really rare to see... No, it's not that we don't lose a lot of devs. We do, but it's really rare to see a game biz person who, you know, had a 20-year career. There just aren't that many. Most of them come in, do 5-8 years, make a pile of money, and leave. So, to me, the industry is the developers. We just endure the other shifts. So, the conference
doing
is...
doing it for passion.
That's, yeah, right? I mean,
Not in it for the money.
We make games because we love making games. Yeah. If we could probably make more money doing other things in a lot of cases. And so... you know, E3, when it started, was really a conference for biz people to sell to different biz people. It was a conference for publishers to sell to distributors and retailers. That's what it was about. Well, there are no distributors anymore. They used to have giant booths.
Sure.
And they don't exist. It's like a segment of the industry just vanished, right? It's they got eaten. And retailers,
in the cloud.
Yeah, and retailers aren't even relevant anymore, right? So it's not. It used to be Walmart was a make or break for you. They could like destroy your game, and now it doesn't matter. So, you know, if that's what E3 was for, then what do you do, right?
Well, they seem to be just pushing it towards for the fans, right? It's just the interface to connect with people.
That's a valid niche. Yeah, that's a good niche.
It just means
elsewhere.
I have no need to go there, like in terms of to learn anything about what else is going on.
No,
right?
I kind of feel for these kids who are going to be saving up $250 or whatever it is for a ticket to go to this kind of Elysian field of gameplay that they keep hearing about and reading about online and all of their gems, the journalists they follow go to, and then realizing that they've paid all that money to queue up for 5 hours to play 10 minutes of a game that's not coming for 18 months.
That's the thing. It isn't in E3's DNA to actually be that show. Right, that's never been what it is about. It was those queues were designed for press people, not for fans.
Yeah.
A show designed for fans looks like PAX, not like E3.
Yeah.
Right?
It's trying to do both, or it has been. It sounds like they're trying to shift it. I mean, even for the fans is kind of unnecessary. I grew up in the era of like magazines being the primary source of information, and now like the thought of needing to pay attention and going to see things live or trying it is so unnecessary when, there's so many other games to play at any given time. That's a separate issue. But just between streaming, between early access, between, just the myriad of ways to obtain information about things that are in progress, it's just like seeing it live doesn't matter. It's not like you only saw images on a piece of paper.
Well, that's the thing. A show for the fans isn't about seeing the games. It's actually about hanging out with the other fans.
Yeah.
Right?
And celebrating them.
So it's a completely different thing, right?
That's
you go to PAX.
PAX is better at it.
Yeah, you go to PAX to hang out with the other people at PAX.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All, like half of the fun of PAX seems to be on all the little squishy chairs all over. Everyone hanging out playing Monster Hunter, right?
We put on a couple of consumer shows back in the UK. One's kind of very indie focused, one in London, and we have a bigger sort of more broader one in Birmingham, and we were hoping it was going to be successful. We didn't realise how successful they were going to end up being, but it is the social scene that's the biggest thing that's taken off.
People
just want an area to hang out together, and they'll play 10 minutes of a game with a friend, and then they'll talk about it with each other for 3 hours. That's the key thing.
They like that the dev is there.
Yeah.
It's cool, but it's not the point.
And I think that's sort of, we put on developer sessions as well, and sort of the passion that these guys have to see the people who are making the games is incredible. I mean, the session we were in this morning, Justin, we went to see the Civ retrospective, and it was absolutely packed full of professionals. And everyone you could see sitting there talking about how inspired they've been by this game and by Civ.
It was a very easy audience.
Yeah, you didn't really have to put anything too controversial to keep people listening.
Yep.
We touched there a little bit on, and this is a pretty blunt segue, but talking about people on the business side who are there to make money and then get out. We saw a couple of new people getting into the publishing game this week, and I wouldn't suggest that this is what they're trying to do at all. But seeing Humble getting into publishing, and even tiny people like Coffee Stain Studios who did Goat Simulator recently. There's been I saw a slide. I think it was in Christian Segerstrahler's talk at the beginning of the week. Sort of a timeline that just had a little peak that just said, and then a billion indie publishers suddenly appeared. Do you think is this sustainable? I think, seeing the slate that Humble have got, it's amazing. There's some really cool stuff here. Are we going to be reaching saturation point for that? Are we going to start
in terms of saturation point of publishers?
Yeah,
I think it's heavily a response to the fact that there are so many more indie developers and therefore so many more indie developers that find their work to be unsustainable, and either by failing or just by not enough money to go around to support that type of production. And I feel like the existence of these new indie publishers is trying to fill the void of maintaining that sort of principles and spirit behind indie developers while still letting people hedge their bets and not every single game betting your life savings on at least breaking even. And so I think there's been this sort of collective anxiety building in the indie space, and I think this is a lot of people who are like, I was lucky enough to be successful. We were lucky enough to have enough money, more money than we perhaps should have from the pool of indie developers, and let's just sort of spread out this buffer to protect other people. Whether or not that's every publisher's mindset, I don't know, but that's just the feeling of the general zeitgeist that I get.
Yeah, I take the long view. I'm cynical about it in the end. I think that the large-scale market forces are... we're at mature markets now. And in mature markets, the middle gets hollowed out. They either get bought by the big guys or they slip down and become the lower tier, right? The lower tier makes less money, and there's usually too many of them, and a lot of them get filtered out. And it often has very little to do with quality of the work, right? Unfortunately, it's just kind of how it is. In mature markets, people with marketing clout win. And if you had lots of money, then that's one way to have marketing clout. Aggregation is a different way to have marketing clout, right? So basically everybody's...
Virality.
Right. People are scrambling to get ways to have that clout. It's just kind of the cycle of life. I've seen it before. It's going to be we're entering an ugly time period for indie, right? Yeah. Costs are just skyrocketing. And it's going to get worse. Whoever happened to get, I say lucky, but obviously there was a substantial component of skill, but whoever managed to actually build enough of a nest egg has to basically make a choice, because the middle, you're not going to be able to stand in the middle. Over the long haul, that's, we remember the middle used to be Bullfrog and Origin and Sierra, and they're gone, right? They're gone. You end up with either the giants or the tiny, and the tiny is a bit of a crapshoot, right? It's like lightning strikes. And so, we're not there yet, but you can kind of see the line. So I love that the indies are basically banding together to... They're basically, in a way, Humble is trying to be a big guy and have this umbrella for people, right?
So do what you want to do. If you don't succeed, that's fine, because we'll make sure you can still eat.
But on the other hand, if Humble succeeds, and this is nothing against the Humble people, right? If Humble succeeds, they should also remember the lesson of the original company that said, wow, we need to band together and protect a whole bunch of indie developers that are doing astonishing creative work because they are software artists. Electronic Arts was born that way, and Activision was born as, we are the indies under the weight of Atari, let us band together and actually credit people for their games. And today they're behemoths. So... in some ways, the strategy is the seeds of its own destruction. Now, I hope Humble never becomes Activision, but if they are truly successful,
That's part of the cycle of life.
not to doubt the lessons from experience, but I do feel personally that there's a bit of a different situation. It's just slightly different in that a lot of the end goal of the people in the indie space is not to scale up, and mm-hmm. which means the cost of production, you know, especially like you were saying with the new tools that are appearing. It's leveling the playing field where you can just have a couple of people create incredible things easily for like almost no money. And the fact that some of those, like you say, by fortune or by luck or by skill, can just make just inordinate amounts of money, it feels different. It feels like you know, there's no business people involved in anyone that I speak to or anyone I interact with, right? Where I'm not trying to convince anyone that we're trying to grow a company to be able to make, you know, exponentially more profits or anything like that. It just, whether or not that's a sustainable market, who knows? Presumably it's going to filter out those and separate into people who are willing to do that and who don't. Yeah. But it does feel like this specific situation, it's not like exactly the same. It feels more like a creative space rather than a market, rather than a purely for profit.
I think it is now, but I think profit is a deadly trap, basically, and it seduces. So, sure. I think
maybe those people are just replaced by the new ones, and just there will be this weird bubble of
You make enough money, yeah. and all of a sudden it's like, wow, okay, we actually got this big. Maybe we can afford marketing, or maybe we can afford and it just kind of happens to you, and eventually people, you know.
I mean, nobody makes a game to not sell it, right? You know,
people do make games to not sell it. I think that's one of the wonderful things about indie, is that a lot of people do make games just for self-expression.
Well, you're describing something that is what I'm actively trying to fight against at all times.
No, I know. And it is.
Are you self-publishing for?
Yeah, and we spent $0 on marketing, and then, like, if we're trying to maintain that spirit of like we're just making something that we want to make, and that's it. If there's not
a luxury there, having had a big success,
of course, there's the only reason why we have that option is because, mm-hmm. granted, even if we didn't have the big success, who knows? But you know, when we made FTL, we were doing the same thing because we knew that we could live in China for dirt cheap.
Right.
Like the cost of living, a year was like less than $10,000 for us, you know, eating simple food all the time. So, like, I can't say if I would just go get a job then, but, like, it's totally doable to maintain that perspective even with very minimal income.
Yeah.
But it's at great sacrifice to other things.
Right. I mean, you say that till you have kids, right? It's what happens. And so,
sure.
I think that's fundamentally the thing. That's why I say it's kind of cyclical. You know, there will come a point where there's an awful lot of small indie games being made. And part of the issue is that the distribution channels are just, you know, it's really hard to get stuff to pop. Really, really hard. And so there are going to be an awful lot of indies who will do what you're describing and then not sell a copy.
For sure.
And they just won't be able to do it. Yeah, they just won't be able to keep going. So it's really unfortunate. I think it's deeply unfortunate. I mean, I agree with you, because I think we're going to lose a lot of really wonderful voices that way.
And I think it's because we put up this, maybe people like me are at fault here, where we put up this sort of feeling that it is possible to be super successful, and all these people feel like this promise has been a lie when they get into it, and then you get into the situation.
A lot of it is structural, right? So, for example, video games have truly shitty IP protection, right? Truly shitty compared to every other medium, right?
Sure.
We have the least. The mechanics aren't protectable, whatever. And it's not that I'm a huge fan of like copywriting or patenting or anything, but
design.
Yeah, it's one example of infrastructure that other media have. And some of the others, the biggest, royalties, right? Other media have the concept of royalties, and games don't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, residuals, right?
Sure.
The fact that somebody like Donna Bailey does not make a dime off of Centipede, when Centipede today probably still makes bank, right? Is tragic. I mean, it's I mean, it's insulting and disgusting, frankly, right? And so we just lack all of that infrastructure. I had a lot of great conversations, including one on stage at Indiecade about 2 years ago with Greg Kostikian, right? Now, for podcast listeners who don't know, Greg got his start doing tabletop games, and we're talking ones like Paranoia, okay, like classic tabletop games. And he was Designer X, the guy who wrote the Indie Manifesto and hugely kicked off the entire indie game movement in the mid-2000s. As late as 2006, it was possible to write a headline, "Why There Is No Indie Scene in Video Games." Like, that was an actual headline, right? And he really helped kickstart such a thing. But he and I have had a lot of conversations about, is there a way to do things like residuals? Is there a way to change the IGDA into something more like a performance rights organization that can offer ongoing, like, could we get like pennies per play? Could like a Google or Apple detect plints or Steam detect plays? And could it be distributed in a way that wasn't flat? He suggested, and Humble, I don't know what structure Humble is using, but he's a big fan of the Rochdale Co-op, which is business cooperatives that are owned by everybody. So, like, I don't know, one of the hardware stores is like this, grocery stores are sometimes like this, where every worker part owns the whole thing. And so everybody's fates kind of rise and fall together. But in video games, well, another example of absent infrastructure is unionization, sure, right? And this kind of stuff is in the air. We've been talking about it for a few years already because it's really clear.
Do you think these things can change in such a large scale?
It's a great question.
The industry has grown like so fast, disproportionately.
It has internationally
as well. Yeah. You know, trying to kind of get that into law across.
Yeah, it would be very difficult.
Be learning right now from the bad lessons we may be teaching as a whole, like China, for example, the game industry is going like crazy.
Yeah, we're in an economic moment right now. All of those, like when that was set up for music, was kind of like late Industrial Revolution. When that was set up for other things, you know, it was during a very different period, in reaction to large-scale economic forces. And right now, we're in a very libertarian, very free market, very even monopoly-minded economic world. So when a scrappy mobile indie eventually becomes king, or a scrappy Facebook indie eventually gets acquired by EA, it's seen as the natural order of things,
a lot of the indies are trying to fight against that concept, like in spirit. Like a lot of the people I know, I can never imagine them forming a company to become. I mean, who knows? 20 years, people change, but yeah.
In Supercell, like one of the richest mobile companies in the world, when they got acquired by SoftBank, the guys from there went out and paid their taxes. They took out a double page ad in the Finnish national paper and said, "We're so proud to pay back our taxes to the country that's helped us to make this money." They just, there was only 16 of them in the company. Everyone became millionaires overnight.
Yep.
Nobody left. If that happened in the UK, most of the small companies I know, you'd see them for dust. They would be living in TE, and they would be doing everything they can to become tax efficient.
But again, I mean, we just mentioned King giving away their game engine. No strings attached, right? So there is a cultural... there is a cultural thing. Yeah. I agree. But I think it's to some degree generational, too, right?
Yeah. Geographically as well, I think, you know, you see this a lot in Scandinavia, and you know, the more you travel in that area, the one thing I really wish that other geographical kind of regions would learn from that is this sort of inbuilt socialism, and this kind of, it's a slightly dirty word over here, but you know, this kind of, you know, approach to things.
Could not agree more, and I absolutely see that, especially, you mentioned Scandinavia, to me the standout is Finland. Mm-hmm. The level of... cooperation and friendship between studios that are allegedly competitors in Finland is amazing. It's wonderful.
This concept is the only reason why I am in indie games, I think, is because there's such a... When I went to the first GDC and I was like, oh, this is what I want to do, and I quit and made FTL or whatever, it was because there of this feeling of camaraderie in the indie space of, you know, my success is not contingent on your failure, you know, like if one person succeeds, that improves everyone else's lives as well. And so that sort of feeling, which, you know, maybe is being diluted by just the broad swaths of people who are becoming indie and with different perspectives and bringing new ideas, but just that general feeling seems to persist at least among a lot of people. And
it does. I think the place where it's the thing that puts it at risk is, for a while we were in, you know, to use biz speak, we were in blue ocean territory. There was lots of room. But the more the charts have come to drive, you know, at this point, charts are the top marketing avenue for quite a lot of people. And it's
streaming.
and streaming, right? But streaming in some ways is even harder than charts. It's a very limited shelf. In some ways, it's worse than Electronics Boutique was once upon a time. There's less slots that are less visible to reach larger audiences.
But there's still the illusion that it's accessible by anyone, like, you know, it's a false Stardew Valley or something.
Yeah, it's a false illusion, though. Like, because
for the 99%.
Yes, it's confirmation bias, right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, every time the IGF comes around and, you know, I sit on the jury and you get this enormous list, you think, holy shit, there's all this amazing stuff that's come out this year that I've... Someone who spends their professional life trying to find out about this stuff has never
heard. Right. I mean, I judge awards every year, and still there are games that show up at IGF that I've literally never even heard of, right? But the thing is, those were the winners.
Yeah.
Meaning, to get noticed enough to make it to IGF means you've already filtered out, you know, 10,000 things, right? And so... that's what I mean by it's structural, right? And I think that this is something all the storefronts have been trying to solve, the discovery problem. Now we've got Steam Direct versus Greenlight trying to solve it. But fundamentally, the question is, in serving the audience ends up happening through curation in one way or another. Because as the market gets fuller, there need to be ways to...
You can't self-curate thousands of games every year.
Well, but they're effectively... It happens whether they want to or not. If they have
a
front page...
No, I just mean every individual can't see it.
No,
every
an individual can't.
That's what I'm
saying. Yeah, totally, yeah. So effectively, the storefronts are doing it. They're picking winners and losers, and they pick winners and losers in particular. You know, they can try to do it in fair ways or whatever, but fundamentally, that's what happens. Getting into Humble is also curation, right? It's like... Yeah, you made it in the bundle. You are now a winner. You didn't make it.
Steam
you're
has
not.
Tried quite a lot of things, right? So they did the you know, your personal, you have your own personal Steam front page, right? And you could follow people, you know, that kind of independent curation. And they freely admitted that that just didn't work. They were actually getting fewer views on, you know, the views of each game page was being concentrated more and more towards the top.
That
because people on their personal curation pages were saying, well, these are the 10 most popular games, of course they're going to be on the
right
page.
There's a network effect thing that happens. The more connected a network is, the bigger the hubs. And so what that does is it just kind of concentrates hits. But that is why in mature markets, that's the problem. Why publishers end up turning into what they do is because in markets like that, to stay a hub, when the requirement to hub keeps getting bigger, you have to keep doubling down on IP, you have to keep doubling down on marketing, you have to keep doubling down on production values, you have to keep doubling down on monetization things, because otherwise you slowly slip away. And that's the seductive trap, right? So I absolutely hope it gets avoided, but I worry that it's actually... It won't be their fault. It will be the distribution channel structure's fault. It'll be the fault of storefronts, right?
It's just kind of painful because with every choice, I can see the intention, I can see the attempt, I can see the reasoning, and I have yet to see something that resolves any of these.
Through for FTL, you know, what was the point where you really kind of broke into that public consciousness?
I mean, you know, FTL was in Steam before Greenlight and stuff, so we were, like, right at that last group. It's hard to say. We first went on to IGF China in China, and that's when we first got nominated. We're like, oh, maybe this is actually something people would be interested in, at which point we started submitting to other things, and we got honorable mentions in the IGF, and we got... On Live had us like show at GDC randomly. Mm-hmm. And I think it's hard to say what, it's just the confluence of all these things that happened at the same time. We did that Kickstarter, mm-hmm. like at the same time that Double Fine did theirs. Like, I thought Kickstarter was going to be just a nice way to have family give us money, right? And then and then everybody in the industry is looking at Kickstarter. Yep. So it's just a lot of happy coincidences being put in front of the eyes of other people. And I think one of the biggest reasons why FTL sort of gripped people in the industry was just the fact that it was appealing to people who made games. Like, the people who liked it the most were those people who cared about games the most, for whatever reason, itching some scratches. And so, like, when a whole company is acknowledging this game and everyone has tried it, and then that just makes it really easy for people just to have it generally be in the dialogue, and then everything else just sort of follows from there. We didn't have to do, like, I have to do very little to get to talk to press, even back then, you know. And, you know, that's the only reason why we were able to appeal to people, because I had no idea what we were doing. Like, I don't know how to talk to press. We didn't do any marketing, not because of a grand decision, but because, like, A, we didn't have time, B, we wouldn't know how to do it if we tried. So yeah, it was FTL is one of those very random side examples that you know, I don't know what sort of lessons can be learned from.
Although, you know, a lot of people would say being in a bunch of indie festivals and...
It's true.
That is marketing. Yeah.
You know, you can only be lucky, you know, what's that, the only way to get, to win the lotteries, you know, a good example, but you have to be in the right place mm-hmm. to be able to have luck become an option. Yeah. Because if you don't show to anything, you don't show to anyone, no matter how good it is, it's impossible. There's zero chance.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I think that's a good note to round up on. Thanks very much, guys. Justin, really enjoyed Into the Breach. Good luck with that.
Thank you, yeah.
And I hope you both have a great rest of the week.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks for having us.
Bye, guys.